Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
Welcome to this joint podcast hosted by ICMA and the Red Cross to talk about the role of capital markets in humanitarian financing, which is a really nascent but exciting field and much needed. My name's Simon Meldrum. I work in innovative finance at the British Red Cross, and I'm delighted to be joined by Cyrus Ardlin and Bob Parker. Cyrus, as many of you will know, has had a long career in the world of banking and investment banking. He's currently a non-exec on a number of institutions, including at Citibank's International Investment Bank, Oak North, Challenger Bank. But in today's session, he's specifically speaking in his capacity of chair of the board of IFIM, which is one of the vehicles we'll be speaking about. Bob Parker is chair of the Asset Manager and Investors Council at ICMA. Welcome to the podcast. And why are we talking about the role of capital markets, humanitarian financing? Just to set the scene, the need for humanitarian assistance is growing. It's already 5 times greater today than it was in the previous decade. And the World Economic Forum projects that that requirement will in fact double to $50 billion a year by 2030. So although humanitarian assistance is growing, the needs are growing more quickly, and new and different sources of capital are required as governments' budgets are under constraint and likely to stay static or decrease. We're looking to new sources. And one of the things that the Red Cross is engaging on is this subject of innovative humanitarian financing, which is a very broad descriptor of looking at non-traditional ways to fund our work. So these are ideas around using capital markets, but also using fintech and using insurance requirements. To put the numbers in context of the sums of humanitarian financing, the total envelope of international humanitarian assistance annually is about $27 billion. In the light of COVID, as of June 2020, the UN forecast humanitarian needs is about $37 billion for this year. However, that has resulted in a gap from that committed and pledged of about $20 billion. Cyrus, thanks for joining us today on the podcast. Could you explain a little bit about what IFIM is and what it's done and its track record?
Thank you very much, Simon. I'd be delighted to. IFIM was established in the year 2006 as a mechanism to help dramatically accelerate the vaccination of children in the poorest developing countries. Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccination, was created in the year 2000, essentially driven by Bill Gates, plus all the industrialized countries, as a private-public partnership involving key stakeholders in helping children get vaccinated in poor countries. It started operations in 2000, but it decided that it really needed to accelerate this process. And in 2006, IFIM was created. And it did this through a very simple mechanism. It allowed governments, in this case, it was 10 governments, to commit funds, substantial funds, $6.5 billion, over the medium to long term. In some cases, the funds were committed over a 23-year period. And what IFIM, the structure, allowed us to do was to take these long-term commitments from these 10 governments and issue securities against them, in effect, front-load these commitments and provide the funding to Gavi immediately or when required, hence enabling Gavi to dramatically accelerate its operations. So at one level, it's helped Gavi accelerate its operations. At another level, it provided Gavi with long-term financing that they could draw on flexibly when and if needed. And all of that has been incredibly important in allowing Gavi to achieve what it has, which is to vaccinate over 800 million children since its inception in the year 2000.
Brilliant. Thanks, Cyrus, for that introduction. Bob, coming to you as chair and someone who wasn't directly involved with IFIM, what's your views and understanding of these kinds of tools to support humanitarian assistance and interventions?
Thank you, Simon. I think the first point to make is that there are some very good examples where the capital markets have shown good innovation. And I would really sort of highlight three areas here. First of all, which the International Capital Markets Association has been heavily involved in, is the development of the green bond market. And you know, that started some years ago as a very fledgling bond market and almost has now become a mainstream bond market. And you know, it's also supported by a number of official institutions, and you know, particularly the EU with its environmental agenda over the next few years. So that's the first example of innovation. I think the second example is the catastrophe bond market and the insurance-linked securities bond market. And that obviously is very relevant as an insurance vehicle for humanitarian aid, where insurance, for example, against pandemics is required. And basically what has happened there is that the capital market has taken on risk where previously that risk was essentially covered by insurance companies. So it's moved from insurance companies to securities. And obviously, there are occasional shocks to the catastrophic bond market just by the very nature of its business. It is there to insure against catastrophes, but it has a wide investor base, and the overall performance of cat bonds and insurance-linked securities actually has been very attractive, particularly recently in the very low yield environment. I think the other area where, you know, the track record, frankly, has been somewhat erratic is the whole area of securitization. When I say the track record is erratic, there have been some huge successes in securitization. But conversely, you know, one shouldn't forget, you know, the problems of 2008, 2009, where there was quite significant opaque risk loaded into securitized issues such as CDOs and CBOs, where there was also leverage and where, you know, that was part and parcel of one of the problems in the financial crisis of 2008. But, you know, the capital markets have provided, I think, good examples of innovation. And I think those examples could be applied to the development of securities which are linked to assisting humanitarian issues.
Thanks, Bob, for that summary. And I think the green bonds does act as a really good inspiration for what can be achieved, you know, given that it started in 2007 and is now a substantial market in itself and could certainly address some of the funding needs for the humanitarian areas. I'll come to Cyrus. Cyrus, do you want to talk a little bit about some of these themes and areas and the types of financing that have been used to address humanitarian issues and development issues?
If you look at the IFIM itself, what IFIM was able to do was to essentially use the capital markets to bridge the timing of financing that was going to be provided by governments on one side and the need for the funds, which was immediate. And that type of mechanism, IFIM's type of mechanism, can be very, very powerful in the future and apply to other social areas such as sanitation, education, other areas of health, etc., where resources are required immediately, quickly to address the issues, but the availability of these resources spread over time. And so capital markets come in and provide a bridging aspect to it. And in the case of IFIM, you know, we've issued nearly $7 billion worth of bonds to do this. The other areas, for example, would be to look at capital markets where we issue securities which are essentially based on the impact of the outcomes, where you have investments being made in areas where the impact can be identified clearly and can be quantified. It is possible to create securities and to have the returns of these securities linked to the impact that the bonds have, and thereby provide investors with an attractive risk-return profile, which would lead them to invest in these securities. Bob mentioned the use of securities essentially to replace insurance or to create insurance-type products. That's another example, which has been done and I think can be done very well. The other is to look at blended finance, where the risks associated with certain types of activity may be difficult to quantify, or there are a lot of externalities, and you try and create structures which blend funds from the market with funds available through, for example, either governments or multilateral development agencies that are either in a position to assess the risks more effectively or are prepared to step in to take on these risks because of the positive externalities that the projects that are being financed have. So I think there's a whole range of different opportunities there. And I think one of the key challenges is to get people together and to look at where the various key stakeholders who are positioned to take what type of risks and in what form. And by bringing these multiple groups together, you can create a whole variety and family of different types of structures, which allocate, distribute the risk to those that are in the best position to take it and thereby facilitate access to private sector funding.
Really interesting to hear that the dichotomy of the field and some of the different areas that capital markets can contribute. And, you know, certainly the need is there, and the interest to make it happen is really necessary. Bob, what do you see as some of the opportunities or the challenges to realizing this?
Well, let's first start on challenges. I think the first point to make is that we are operating in a very low yield, or in many markets, a negative yield environment. And just to quantify that, if one looks at sort of 10-year German government bond yields, you know, we're at about minus 60 basis points at the moment. If you look across Europe, there are many markets, government bond markets, you know, such as the French market, the Dutch market, where yields are in negative territory. In US treasuries, you know, 10-year yields are, despite the recovery this year from the pandemic and the fiscal expansion, you know, we've still got 10-year yields under 90 basis points. And obviously, you know, that is a very challenging environment for longer-term institutional investors such as pension funds and insurance companies. That in turn, that challenge, however, does represent an opportunity, because investors are looking at other areas where they can achieve positive yields. And if one can discover a way of providing humanitarian finance in such a way that there is, you know, a bond or a security which provides a positive return, then there's going to be a very strong appetite for that. Now, having said that, you know, one doesn't want to get into a situation where bonds are issued by whether it's supranational institutions or others for humanitarian purposes, where the yields are too high. So one needs to get a balance between the need for by insurance companies and pension funds for a positive yield against the requirement that humanitarian finance has to be well managed and should not come expensively. I think the other challenge is what I call sort of risk transparency. And we look at where, and I touched on this earlier, if we look at where securitized product got itself into trouble in 2008, it's where risk was opaque. And, you know, in many cases, I really question whether investors fully understood the risks in the securities that they were investing in. And, you know, this is, again, I think, an interesting challenge for humanitarian finance, whereby if there is a return based on certain outcomes, whether it's a pandemic, whether it is, you know, other issues which affect society, I think there has to be a very transparent mechanism for analysing and risk managing any outcomes. So, you know, that risk of transparency, I think, you know, is an absolute requirement before a bond market or a securitized market for humanitarian finance can be developed. I think that's achievable, but it is obviously going to require some work.
Thanks, Bob, for the discussion and the ideas of highlighting the issue for transparency, and I think which is vitally important, and actually one of the things that many humanitarian actors are well able to do, given that they've been reporting and accounting for spend to government. So actually, while they're not financially sophisticated, reporting and transparency that operates at quite a high level in the humanitarian sector. Cyrus, I'll come to you now and ask you about one of the issues Bob had highlighted about balancing risk and return and accounting for impact.
I think one of the interesting and important developments in the last few years has been a sea change in investor focus on lending to areas which have either a environmental or a social or, as I say, governance, ESG aspect to them. And when one considers the pool of assets under management, which is well over $100 trillion, and the fact that a large percentage of these pools now have a specific ESG mandate attached to them, there is now a real appetite and interest on the part of institutional investors to find attractive means of investing in these critical areas. So that is now very much in place. I think what is also the case is that there has been a very rapid growth in ESG type of financing, but it still remains very, very modest. If you look at the pool of assets, which is 100 trillion, ESG type financing per annum is a couple of hundred billion at most. So it's really a very relatively small amount. The key is to try and align the risk return requirements of institutional investors with the type of projects that need to be financed on the other side. And I think that requires, as Bob mentioned, part of it has to do with being very transparent on what exactly these projects are. And the other part is to be able to identify the risks associated with these projects, with these initiatives, and try and structure instruments which enable the private sector to step in and make an objective risk return assessment and invest in these areas. That, I think, requires really quite a lot of work between the various stakeholders involved. It involves basically the key users of these funds, namely the humanitarian institutions, to be able to articulate exactly what the purpose of the funding is and what sort of impact it has and how that can be quantified. It involves bringing in third parties, which may need to take, as I mentioned earlier, slices of these risks. And finally, the investment banks, which are very critical in providing a bridge to the humanitarian institutions on one side and the institutional investors on the other side, and bringing all these parties together to craft the type of securities that will enable us to increase bond issuance in the sector from the couple of hundred billion that we see a year to multiples of that, which is what is required to be able to address the social issues that we face. And I think finally to say that, you know, with COVID, what is interesting is that I think what COVID has highlighted is the interdependencies in the globe. So ESG is not a nice thing to have, but in many ways, I think people recognize that it is an essential element to have, and it really impacts people directly. And it's not, you're not doing it just for the sake of humanity, but you're also doing it for your own sake, because by helping improve the economic and social environment, you're ultimately improving the returns on your own existing pool of assets.
Bob, how do you see the rise of people looking beyond risk and return and looking at impact, environmental issues, the ESG aspects that Cyrus mentioned, developing the capital markets? And does that suggest opportunities for funding of humanitarian action?
Yeah, before I answer that, I'd just like to pick up on sort of one theme that we have discussed, which is the need for private sector finance. And you know, if one looks at budget deficits around the world in 2021, you know, after the impact of the COVID pandemic, you know, it's highly likely that the Eurozone, those countries, will have a budget deficit next year of probably 7% of GDP, the UK 10% of GDP, and frankly, similar numbers for other economies such as Japan and the United States. And, you know, I think an unfortunate fact of life is that governments are under quite significant financial pressure, and that will continue for the next 2 to 3 years. So I think the first point to emphasize is that in developing humanitarian finance in one form or another, there is going to be a clear reliance on private sector funding. Now, one way that governments and supranational institutions can address that, and it comes back to this issue of private-public partnerships, is that, you know, governments don't necessarily have to provide money, but they can provide longer-term credit guarantees. And therefore, I think one area which will develop in humanitarian finance actually will be in what I call credit enhancement, whereby investors are given a reassurance as to the risk that they are taking on because there is some form of guarantee, whether it be from, you know, a development bank like the World Bank or from governments. So I think that's going to be one important theme for this project. So another area which is of relevance to raising money for humanitarian purposes is to look at an area which the International Capital Markets Association has worked very hard on, which is sustainability-linked bonds. And these are a variant on green bonds, whereby if a company issues a bond and it achieves a, for example, a sustainability or an environmental objective, then it pays a lower interest rate. If, however, it does not achieve those objectives, then the interest that it pays is subsequently higher. So there is quite a strong incentive for the issuer to achieve those sustainability or environmental objectives. And I think that the use of sustainability-linked bonds, actually, a similar process could be applied to raising money for humanitarian finance. Now, again, you know, one needs to be very clear on the risks here and, you know, what are the rules defining, you know, whether a company or an issuer has actually achieved the green bond market rules or not, and also to be clear on what is the interest penalty for failure to comply. But again, you know, that is an example of impact credit. And I do think that although the impact bond market so far has actually been fairly limited, I think it's fair to say it's been mainly addressed in the loan market rather than the securities market. I do think that subject to very clear rules on what we mean by making an impact, I do think that there is scope for development there.
Great to hear those positive words and that you see some scope. And I think, well, what people call impact bonds is really a very small market. Really, they're not a security, albeit they're called impact bonds. They have existed for around 10 years. They were developed in the UK. They actually, in total size over 10 years, is about 400 million in total. So we're not talking about impact bonds, but talking about other ideas like IFM or using the inspiration of green bonds or, in fact, the social bonds. I want to come back to Cyrus, with COP26 coming to the UK in November next year. Where do you see the opportunities for the growth of these ideas around using capital markets for innovative finance?
I think there are a lot of potential opportunities in the context of climate control. For example, one option is to replicate the structure that we have in IFM, to try to use that structure essentially to enable governments to make commitments over very long periods of time, but at the same time use the capital markets through issuing securities to front load these and make the funds available today to address the pressing issues that we face in the environmental sector. And given the type of constraints that we're facing on government budgets today, Bob mentioned, this is precisely the type of mechanism that would work very well because it allows governments to spread the burden over many years, but reap the benefits of those up front. I think, again, the use of the type of structures that Bob also mentioned in the context of essentially impact type of securities, where we identify very clear returns associated with taking certain environmental actions and link those to the payout structure of securities, is something which will definitely, I think, have traction. The other is basically what I would say the more vanilla type of financing, which we have seen. Green bonds essentially are unstructured securities. They're pretty vanilla type of securities, but they're linked to a very specific purpose. And again, what we have been seeing over the last several years is a very significant growth in green bonds as institutions have tried to sort of signal the fact that the funds that are raising are being utilized to address specific environmental issues. And with the much increased focus on environmental considerations, the type of vanilla financing will increase. For example, if you look at Citibank, they made an announcement fairly recently by their CEO talking about the fact that Citibank will commit $250 billion of financing over the next 5 years, or facilitate rather, $250 billion of financing for ESG type of initiatives. So I think there's a full range of the type of instruments we've been discussing that can be applied very concretely to addressing climate control. And I think it will be essential to do that because the resources required are very, very significant. And the ability of governments to fund these have been even in the past constrained, but will be even more so in the future.
Thanks for that. Bob, what do you see as some of the challenges about this new ideas, this nascent field? How do you see it developing and what needs to be done to make it happen?
I think, first of all, let's look at the investor base, and estimates of assets under management worldwide vary significantly. Cyrus mentioned earlier on a figure of about $100 trillion. But if you include personal savings, if you include assets in private banks, you know, one can achieve an estimate which is actually significantly higher than that. So we know there is a very large investment and savings pool out there. We also know that investors, as I mentioned earlier, are struggling in this low or negative yield curve environment. And no, that's just not nominal yields, it's also real yields. And you know, although we've got positive nominal yields in the US, real yields are negative and are likely to stay negative for a long period of time. If we look at, you know, the investor base, whether it be sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, insurance companies, endowments, family offices, that's the institutional marketplace. But obviously, we've also got a very substantial retail investor marketplace, whether it's investors going into exchange-traded funds, passive investing, or into the mutual fund market, which is obviously dominated by active investment. One theme over recent years, obviously, has been the very significant flow of institutional investors and retail investors into passive or indexed investing, and in most cases, using exchange-traded funds as their investment vehicle. So I think to answer your question, I think the first point to make is that we live in a world where investors, whether they be retail or institutional, are really searching for yield and are really struggling investing in markets such as in Europe, where negative yields prevail, or in the States, where yields are negative in real terms, and you know, where there is very significant liquidity sitting on the sidelines. So that really does represent an opportunity. I do think, and I'll pass on to Cyrus in a moment to discuss about the development of a sort of investor issuer forum. But my own view is that the more that one can develop discussion between investors and whether it be issuers or groups such as yourself at the Red Cross who want to develop innovative finance for humanitarian needs, I do think that developing that discussion is absolutely critical. And the opportunity is there. I come back to a point that I've made a couple of times already, is that investors, however, have to have clarity on the risks that they are taking in investing in these securities. But the opportunity is there.
That's great to hear your vision for the opportunities and the size of the potential. You'd identify the need for people to cooperate and discuss. Cyrus, you're behind an initiative to address exactly that.
Yes, Simon. We started a roundtable about a year ago called the Innovations in Humanitarian Financing Forum. And this was created specifically with the view of bringing together the key stakeholders involved in trying to accelerate the use of financing from the private sector for humanitarian purposes. So on one side, we have within this forum a number of humanitarian institutions involved with in the health sector, sanitation, education, etc. On the other side, we have some institutional type investors. In the middle, we have investment banks, which are essentially the link between the investors on one side and the users of funds on the other side. And finally, we have also brought into the picture multilateral institutions such as the World Bank, foundations, as well as insurance companies, which in our view also can play a very critical role in trying to create instruments which provide the right mix of risks and returns so that we can develop instruments which have broad appeal in the market and where different aspects of the risk profile of those instruments can be taken on by different types of institutions that are better suited to taking those on. And we've had three sessions of this forum, and it's been very effective so far in getting the key people together, share ideas on how they themselves are looking at trying to access the private sector funding, having the private sector talk about the challenges in trying to create structures, and beginning to put together an ecosystem where people can work together to try and deal with some of the challenges and difficulties that exist in trying to get this market moving forward. We have also, in this process, worked closely with the World Economic Forum, which itself has created an initiative called the Humanitarian and Resilience Initiative, which is looking at many of the same issues that we're looking at, putting significant resources into this area over the course of the next 18 months to 2 years in research, trying to help develop ideas, as well as promote education amongst the key stakeholders. So in many ways, the forum that we have created is a complement to this, because in the case of our forum, it brings together practitioners looking at very concrete situations, which can work very closely and in collaboration with the work that the WF is planning to do. And hopefully this will all put together a pool of resources in trying to promote this area in a way that we've never had before.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm Simon Meldrum from the Innovative Finance team at the British Red Cross. I'd like to give my thanks to Bob Parker for giving his thoughts and also Cyrus for sharing his views and experience. I hope this has been a stimulating and interesting conversation. And if you want to learn more about this field or in fact the forum or contribute, then there's materials on the website.
Thank you for listening. For more ICMA podcasts and further information on capital markets, please visit our website, icmagroup.org.